Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Daniel chapter 8, which I will entitle The Ram, the Goat, and Antiochus Epiphanes the Fourth. This is a tough chapter. It's not very long, but it's got a lot of prophecy in it. So we begin now in Daniel 8, verses 1 and 2. In the third year of King Belshazzar's reign, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after the one that had appeared to me earlier. I saw the vision, and as I watched, I was in the fortress city of Susa in the province of Elam. I saw in the vision that I was beside the Ulai Canal. Now this vision was in the third year of King Belshazzar. Belshazzar was not actually a king. He was the regent of Babylonia, appointed in 553 BC, according to Wikipedia. In 553, Babylon was securely in power. Nobody would conjecture the fast rise of Alexander the Great, which is going to be prophesied about here in chapter 8. So this shows that Daniel is a great prophet. Unless you want to be a liberal and not believe in prophecy, then you would believe this is history. Alexander the Great's Greek Macedonian Empire is one empire past Persia on the horizon. So this is some great prophecy here. 553 is 33 years past the destruction of Jerusalem by Babylon in 586, and it is 14 years before Belshazzar is going to have his famous feast with the handwriting on the wall as Persia wipes out Babylon. Now, Daniel says that this vision here in chapter 8 is after the one that had appeared to me earlier. That was the vision of the four beasts that had taken place 2 years earlier in the first year of Belshazzar, which we discussed in chapter 7. Daniel 7:1 says this: in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream with visions in his mind as he was lying in his bed. So we're 2 years later. Daniel has another big one, another big vision. Where was he when it happened? This time he wasn't in Babylon, the city of Babylon. He was in the fortress city of Susa. Now, Susa is a very famous city. It was 150 miles east of the Tigris River in modern-day Iran. It's in the south and southwest of modern-day Iran. Susa was prominent in Elamite, Persian, and Parthian history. Elam was an ancient Near Eastern kingdom way back in the thousands B.C., and Susa was its capital. It eventually got conquered by Babylon, so now it's a province in the Babylonian Empire. That's why Daniel was down there. He was on business for Belshazzar. Susa was prominent in Persian history. It was one of the Persian capitals, along with Ecbatana up in the north. In Media, it was prominent in Parthian history, which is the empire that was in charge of the Iranian plateau during the Roman Empire. So it's a famous city. In fact, Daniel died there. Esther was queen there. The whole story of Esther took place in Susa. A tomb of Daniel is purported to be there today. Daniel actually died there, as I said. The city is an active archaeological site today. Why was Daniel in Susa? Well, he was there on the king's business. We read in the last verse of this chapter, I, Daniel, was overcome and lay sick for days. Then I got up and went about the king's business. He got up and went about the king's business. He was down there on business. So Susa, capital of Elam, former kingdom, now a province of Babylon, and more precisely, some more geography. Daniel, in the vision, not where he was, but in his vision, he was beside the Ulai Canal. Now, the Ulai Canal, translated that way by the Holman Christian Study Bible, most translations have it the Ulai River, and BibleAtlas.org has it as the Ulai River, coming down from the mountains right north of Susa, and then coming down south until it's very close to Susa. And then it merges into another branch, and I don't know the name of the river that it merges into, but it eventually runs down into the Shatta El Arab, which is the body of water that is the conjunction of the Tigris and Euphrates River. Well, all of that's hard to see without a map, but I just want to say that it's there, close to Susa. There's no dispute or mystery about where Daniel was or where his vision took place. We go now to Daniel 8, verses 3 and 4. I looked up, and there was a ram standing beside the canal. He had two horns. The two horns were long, but one was longer than the other, and the longer one came up last. I saw the ram charging to the west, the north, and the south. No animal could stand against him, and there was no rescue from his power. He did whatever he wanted and became great. Now ram, which is a male sheep, it's a perfect animal to represent the Persian Empire. A gentleman named Wood gives a quote that says this: Ammianus Marcellinus, a 4th century historian, states that the Persian ruler bore the head of a ram as he stood at the head of his army. And another scholar named Strauss says, the ram was the national emblem of Persia, a ram being stamped on Persian coins as well as on the headdress of Persian emperors. So this is a no-brainer. The ram is Persia. The ram, or a ram, any ram, is strong, powerful. They like to fight. Now, this particular ram had two horns. Both of them were long. The two horns were long, but one was longer than the other. Well, the shorter of the long horns was Media, the famous empire that's north of Persia that Persia merged with or conquered in 550 B.C. Cyrus the Great beat Astyages, the last king of Media. And so it's often called the Medo-Persian Empire because they actually merged. Sort of, it was sort of a confederate-type arrangement. And so the two horns represent the two empires that made up the Medo-Persian Empire, and one horn was longer than the other because Persia was stronger than Media in the alliance. Now, Media was in northern Persia. Modern-day Kurds live there, along with Kurds being further to the west of Media. Now, notice that as an interesting fact. I don't know if it's significant, but it's at least interesting that Persia conquered Media in 550 BC. This is according to Herodotus. There's some dispute about that because Xenophon has a different date, but let's say it's 550 BC and just about at the same time. That's when this vision is being given to Daniel. So Daniel sees a two-horned ram right at the time that the two-horned ram was coming into existence historically. Now, the longer horn came up last, so apparently Daniel watched the horns grow. The shorter of the longer ones came up first, and then one even longer than that came up last. Well, that fits Persia and Media, because Media was in charge at first until the Persians took over. The Persians were at first tributary to the Medians, and then they threw off their Median overlordship. And then they actually supplanted and absorbed the Median Empire. So this vision is perfect, matches history perfectly. And of course, the better prophet is, the more the liberals say, oh, he can't be a prophet, it has to be history. He's a pious fraud. Now this ram was butting or charging to the west, north, and south. Adam Clark says that he charged westward, representing the Greeks, the famous battles of Marathon, Salamis, and Plataea in the 5th century B.C., which was in the next century after Daniel. And then Persia charged north by fighting the Scythians. Those are the people on the plains of southern Russia, north of the Black Sea, north of the Caspian Sea, between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea, in present-day Georgia and Azerbaijan. South of there is Armenia. That area, the Persians did that. And then, of course, southward to the Egyptians. They conquered Egypt in 525 under Cambyses. So once again, this is a perfect picture. Not a lot of controversy about who this ram is. Notice that east is left out. The ram did not charge to the east. Now, Persia did assume some territory to the east, but it made no major conquest in that direction. And so once again, the vision matches history. So we go down to Daniel 8, verses 5 through 8. As I was observing, a male goat appeared, coming from the west across the surface of the entire earth without touching the ground. The goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. He came toward the two-horned ram I had seen standing beside the canal and rushed at him with savage fury. I saw him approaching the ram, and infuriated with him, he struck the ram, shattering his two horns, and the ram was not strong enough to stand against him. The goat threw him to the ground and trampled him, and there was no one to rescue the ram from his power. Then the male goat became very great. But when he became powerful, the large horn was shattered. Four conspicuous horns came up in its place, pointing toward the four winds of heaven. Now, fortunately, this goat imagery is easy to interpret. The goat is the Macedonian Greek Empire, founded by Alexander the Great, who ruled in that empire between 336 and 323 B.C., the late 4th century B.C. Remember, Daniel's in the 6th century B.C., so this is a good ways off. Now, you say, how do I know that's Alexander the Great? Well, it's obvious, but actually Daniel tells us in verse 21, chapter 8, the shaggy goat represents the king of Greece, that's Alexander, and the large horn between his eyes represents the first king, that's Alexander. Now, Daniel didn't give us his name, but we know his name from history. And Adam Clark says that 200 years before the time of Daniel, the people of Alexander's empire were called the Goat's People. Now, this goat came from the west. Of course, Macedon is to the west of Persia. Greece is to the west of Persia. The goat came without touching the ground. This fits Alexander the Great perfectly because Alexander the Great's movements were incredibly fast. He went from Macedon, which is just to the north of Greece, to the border of India in just 13 years of constant military campaigning. Wikipedia says this campaign was one of the most successful military campaigns in history, or the commander was one of the most successful military commanders in history. Alexander was. Now, one needs to read a biography or two of Alexander the Great. It's fascinating history, and you will see that this vision fits the speed of Alexander the Great perfectly. Alexander the Great came without touching the ground. Now, the goat had a conspicuous horn. Now, Alexander the Great is one of the most conspicuous figures of history, even more so than Napoleon or anybody else you can think of. Now, the ram, as we see in the vision, had his two horns shattered. He got thrown to the ground. He got trampled by the goat. There was no one to rescue the ram from the goat's power. If you'll read the story, I think it was Darius the Third was the emperor then, if my memory serves me correctly. Alexander chases him down, captures his wife at one battle, and then the emperor ends up either killing himself or being killed by one of his courtiers as he runs to escape Alexander. I think that happened way out in Bactria, present-day Afghanistan. My memory might be a little bit off from reading the history, but it's very interesting history. But it was a pitiful end to the great Persian Empire, and it happened all of a sudden. Nobody could have expected this. Alexander completely conquered the Persian Empire. One Persian work called him Alexander the Accursed. I read somewhere that people still say way out there in the east, Bactria, Afghanistan, Tajikistan, all the Stan places, all Central Asia where Alexander was, mothers will tell their children, Alexander's going to get you. I think I remember reading some history of the American War between the states when Yankee mothers would tell their children, Jeb Stuart's going to get you. I think it was Jeb Stuart. Might have been Stonewall Jackson. I don't remember, but it was a southern boogeyman going to get the kids. Now, in verse 8, this goat is said to become very powerful in the vision. I imagine he got bigger and bigger in Daniel's vision. Alexander the Great was not only great militarily, but also culturally. As Wikipedia says, his conquests ushered in centuries of Greek settlement and rule over distant areas, a period known as the Hellenistic Age. And if you read the history of the Hellenistic Age, Hellenism was everywhere over that whole empire. It was a world-shattering, changing event, this conquest. Greek culture was everywhere in the east after Alexander the Great. Now, this powerful ram had his big horn shattered in Daniel's vision, and four conspicuous horns came up after the one conspicuous horn. Well, Alexander the Great died suddenly. This was in Babylon after his 13 years of conquest. He had a fever and he died. Nobody really knows. Some people speculate malaria, typhoid, or viral encephalitis. But at any rate, it was a disaster, and of course he had made no plans for his succession, and so his generals fought with each other. Now history has come to know these fighting generals as the Dyadochi. The Dyadochi fought over the remains of the Greek Macedonian Empire. Now, these four conspicuous horns that sprang up from the shattered large horn in Daniel's vision, these represent the four areas of the Greek Empire of Alexander. Now, if we take the four horns to refer to four generals, to four of the Dyadochi, we have a split of opinion. I think there's several options there. I've got two. Cassander was the general that took over Greece and Macedon. Lysimachus took over Asia Minor, or at least the western end of Anatolia. Seleucus took over Syria, Israel, and Persia, and Ptolemy took over Egypt. Wikipedia says that the four most prominent of the Dyadochi are Cassander in Greece, Antigonus in Anatolia, Seleucus in Syria, Israel in Persia, and Ptolemy in Egypt. Those two lists only have one difference, Lysimachus and Antigonus, both of them in Anatolia. I think the best way to look at it is that there were four regions of the empire. The four horns represent the four regions, and we don't worry about which particular general is in charge at a particular time, because that changed over time. If you read the history of the Dyadochi, there were battles between them, and at one time one general held this area and another time this general held that area. It's easier just to say the four areas of Alexander's empire that survived were Greece and Macedon, number one, Asia Minor, number two, that's the Anatolia, present-day Turkey, Syria, Israel, and Persia, which the Seleucid Empire took over, and Egypt, which Ptolemy took over. Now, Seleucus and Ptolemy easily identified with their areas because that didn't change too much, but Greece and Asia Minor did change. So let's just take these four areas. Greece, Anatolia, Syria, Israel, and Persia, number three, number four, Egypt. It fits so well that, again, Daniel was a bodacious prophet. Now, the four conspicuous horns that came up on the goat's head in Daniel's vision, they were pointing in four different directions. The four winds of heaven, that's just a way of saying the four different directions of the earth. We say the four corners of the earth. Now, if you take Israel as the vantage point, the west is Greece, the north is Anatolia, the east is Persia, the south is Egypt. That explains where the four horns took over. It doesn't work so well if you take the Ulai Canal as the vantage point, in which case then you would just say four winds is just a general reference to the fact that the four pieces of Alexander's empire were all over the world, all over the ancient world. We go now to Daniel 8, verses 9 through 12. From one of them, that's from one of the four horns, from one of them a little horn emerged and grew extensively toward the south and the east and toward the beautiful land. It grew as high as the heavenly host, made some of the stars and some of the host fall to the earth and trampled them. It made itself great even up to the prince of the host. It removed his daily sacrifice and overthrew the place of his sanctuary. Because of the rebellion, a host, together with the daily sacrifice, will be given over. The horn will throw truth to the ground and will be successful in whatever he does. The horn will throw truth to the ground and will be successful in whatever it does. Now this little horn, by common consent, is the Seleucid Emperor Antiochus Epiphanes IV, who ruled between 175 and 164. Now I say that everybody identifies the little horn with Antiochus Epiphanes IV, but I just read an article or just downloaded an article, Why the Little Horn of Daniel 8 is Not Antiochus Epiphanes IV. But I think you will see that there's no question about it. This is who is being referred to here. We first must note that the little horn is not the same little horn as in chapter 7, the previous chapter. We discussed that. The little horn in the previous chapter is either Vespasian or Nero, depending on which way the argument goes. A lot of people take the little horn in chapter 7 to refer to Antiochus Epiphanes IV, but the difficulties in doing that, in my opinion, are insuperable. So this is a different little horn and a different vision. A little bit of brief history about Antiochus Epiphanes IV. He was a Seleucid emperor, or Seleucid as sometimes it's said in English. That empire was centered in Antioch. The capital was in Antioch, right to the north of Israel. And the Seleucids, at various times, were in charge of Israel and also Syria, because that's where Antioch is. And you go in east, and it was in charge of areas around Persia, the former Persian Empire. Of course, those boundaries shifted over time. And this particular emperor of the Seleucid Empire, Antiochus Epiphanes IV, was the son of, or the successor of, Antiochus III, the emperor of Seleucia. Antiochus III had conquered Egypt in 198. Took it away from the Ptolemies, and Antiochus had fought Ptolemy the VI Philometor, who ruled from 180 to 164, and then later from 163 to 145, and Antiochus had taken many cities. He besieged Alexandria, didn't take it, and in all probability would have subdued the whole country had not the Romans restrained him. Now, in the midst of all this, Israel is right smack dab in the middle between Egypt and Antioch, between the empire of the Ptolemies and the empire of the Seleucids. Well, in the course of all this, Antiochus Epiphanes had come down and conquered Israel. That occurred between 168 and 165. And this is a big deal for Jewish history, as we'll see. Now, this horn was said to be a little horn in Daniel's vision. He was small compared to the great horn of Alexander the Great. But we see this horn growing toward the south and the east. Toward the south, that's toward Egypt, of course, as I just mentioned. Antiochus Epiphanes IV had two journeys down to Egypt, and this historical confusion over when these trips to Egypt were. I remember reading an article about it. It's very interesting. I can't remember. But at any rate, it's well known that he went down to Egypt. And also, this horn grew extensively toward the beautiful land. Well, that's Israel. And again, as I say, Antiochus Epiphanes conquered Israel between 168 and 165. The little horn in Daniel's vision in verse 9 also grew toward the east. Adam Clark says that refers to Antiochus IV's conquest of Syria and making it a province. Now, most of this apparently appeared after the conquest of Israel. Israel got its nation back under the Maccabees and purified the temple in 164. And by that time, Antiochus had gone back to Syria. And Wikipedia says this, Antiochus had initial success in his eastern campaign, capturing King Artaxias and reconquering Armenia. His campaign went through Ecbatana, that's all the way in northern Persia, and he attacked Persepolis, that's in southern Persia, being driven off by the populace. On his return home, he died at Isfahan in 164 BC. Well, so the horn did grow toward the east. So this prophecy of Daniel fits the career of Antiochus Epiphanes IV perfectly. Now in verse 10, this little horn grew as high as the heavenly host, made some of the stars and some of the host fall to the earth. We have two mentions here, the host and the stars, and they apparently are separate, which is confusing because you usually think of host as stars, and of course stars are stars, but it says some of the stars and some of the host. It's pretty redundant there. And as it turns out, commentators disagree on what the host and the stars are, so let me give you some options. In verse 10, the host is mentioned. They refer to stars according to Barnes Ellicott. Ellicott says probably stars. Another option is Israel. The host stands for Israel. We read in Exodus 12:41, and it came to pass at the end of 430 years, even the selfsame day, it came to pass that all the hosts of Yahweh went out from the land of Egypt. That's Israel on the Exodus. So that's the argument that the hosts stand for Israel. And then, of course, we've got stars mentioned also. Let me read that again. The little horn grew as high as the heavenly host and made some of the stars and some of the hosts fall to earth. Well, the heavenly host is either stars, might stand for Israel, and then we got some of the stars and some of the hosts fell to the earth. So let's just take that pair of words and look at some options here. Options, first of all, as to why is stars repeated. The pulpit commentator says the host of heaven is Israel and the stars are their leaders, the leaders of Israel. As an option, the pulpit commentary suggests that. Also, the pulpit commentary suggests that the host of heaven is Israel and the stars are the Levites. Similar. Moses Stuart, that well-known 19th century theologian, says that the host of heaven is the priest and the stars are the teachers. I don't think so. I like the view that the host of heaven is Israel and the stars are their leaders. Let's look at some options as to what the stars represent, who these leaders are, or who the stars are. Benson says that they are persons of principal dignity and high office. Ellicott and the pulpit commentator suggest that the stars is the same as the host, the people of Israel, is just repeated. Why do stars stand for Israel? Well, in the famous chapter of Genesis, chapter 15, when the Abrahamic covenant was cut with Abraham, God took Abraham outside and said, "Look at the sky and count the stars, if you are able to count them." Then he said to him, "Your offspring will be that numerous." That's the offspring, the descendants, the seed of Abraham are stars. Very famous metaphor. So here the stars could be said to represent Israel, just as hosts represent Israel in Exodus 12. Matthew Poole says that the stars represent believers in God who were in heaven, Jewish believers in God who were in heaven. I don't know how he gets that. Pulpit commentator suggests that the stars were angels. Well, in the midst of all that, let's just say that the host of heaven is Israel and the stars are their leaders. I think that's the simplest way to resolve that. Now, these stars in the vision get thrown to earth and the little horn tramples them. That happened in history, of course, between 168 and 165. Antiochus Epiphanes IV trampled the Jews. And that's some great history there. It's all told in the book of 1st and 2nd Maccabees. It's told by Josephus. If you want to understand prophecy, you need to read history. Now, this little horn in verse 11 made itself great, even up to the prince of the host. Well, who's the prince of the host? That would be God. He's the leader of Israel. The little horn removed God's daily sacrifice, removed his, capital H, in the Holman Christian Study Bible. The little horn removed God's daily sacrifice and overthrew the place of his sanctuary. Now notice there are two things here that the little horn did. He removed the daily sacrifice, that's bad act number one, and then he overthrew the place of God's sanctuary, overthrew the temple, that's act number two, and that will come into play later, so I want you to remember that. Let's talk about the little horn overthrowing the daily sacrifice. Antiochus' suppression of the Jews came to a head in December of 168 B.C. Antiochus Epiphanes was returning in defeat from failing to take Alexandria. He went back up through Israel. He ordered his generals to seize Jerusalem, naturally, on a Sabbath. He perhaps at this time erected an idol of Zeus in the temple, desecrated the altar by an offering of swine, and sprinkled the pig juices in the sanctuary. And according to this take, the daily sacrifice, the evening and morning sacrifice, was ceased because the temple was desecrated. Let's read what Wikipedia says about this. Antiochus issued decrees forbidding many traditional Jewish practices and began a campaign of persecution against devout Jews. Swine were strictly unclean to Jews, but Diodorus wrote, Antiochus sacrificed a great swine at the image of Moses and at the altar of God that stood in the outward court and sprinkled them with the blood of the sacrifice. He commanded likewise that the books by which they were taught to hate all other nations should be sprinkled with the broth made of the swine's flesh. And he put out the lamp, called by them immortal, which burns continually in the temple. That's the seven-branched candlestick. Lastly, Antiochus forced the high priest and the other Jews to eat swine's flesh. Such steps triggered a revolt against his rule, the Maccabean Revolt. Well, you can see, this Antiochus Epiphanes was a real jerk. I'm not even Jewish, but it makes me sick to think of him sprinkling pig's blood on the altar and sacrificing a pig on the bronze altar, sprinkling the altar with pig's blood, and so forth. All right, so Daniel's prophecy that the daily sacrifice will be given over happened exactly in history. Now, I said bad event number two was overthrowing the place of his sanctuary. Now, that could have happened at the same time that the daily sacrifice was stopped, but there's no historical reference that says that that's exactly when the daily sacrifice was stopped. That could have happened before the temple was desecrated for whatever reason. We'll see why that makes a difference in a minute. Now, I said the prince of the host was God. The Holman Christian Study Bible says, even up to the prince of the host, the little horn went, it removed his, capital H, daily sacrifice. Well, I think that's what it is. However, there are some other opinions on that. Pulpit commentators suggest Judas Maccabeus. He's the prince of the host. Of course, he's the head of the Maccabeans who eventually ran the Seleucids out of town. Albert Barnes suggests that the prince of the host is Onias the high priest. Now, we'll see Onias in a minute. Onias III, he was a pious guy who lost his job as the high priest because of Antiochus Epiphanes IV, and that's a reasonable suggestion, I think, so I want to mention that. Benson says of Onias, he thinks the prince of the host is Onias. This Onias, whom Antiochus deprived of his office, putting Jason in his place, an ungodly wretch who set up heathen rites in God's temple. That comes from 2 Maccabees 4. Okay, so it could be Onias and not God. Could be Judas Maccabeus. But we're just going to assume it's God, the prince of the host, that the little horn is fighting against. He's fighting against God. If you say the prince of the host is Onias, then you would say it's Onias' daily sacrifice in the place of Onias' sanctuary that got overthrown. That's possible, but I think it's really God's sanctuary that's being referred to here. Now, all of this happened, this removal of the daily sacrifice and the overthrowing of the sanctuary, it happened in verse 12 because of rebellion. Now, what does this rebellion refer to? Well, the Jews' sins against God is what brought Antiochus Epiphanes into the land the first time. Here's what happened. The first attack of Antiochus against the Jews was to settle a rivalry for the high priesthood. Jason, who was brother of the pious high priest Onias III, bribed Antiochus Epiphanes. He says, Antiochus, I'll give you some money if you'll let me be the high priest. And so Antiochus Epiphanes agreed, and he removed Onias III from office and replaced Onias III with Onias III's brother Jason. But that's not the end of the story, because Onias III had another brother. He gave Antiochus an even bigger bribe. So we'll call Jason the little bribe brother and Menelaus the big bribe brother. So Antiochus Epiphanes, who liked money, he replaced Jason the little bribe brother with Menelaus the big bribe brother. And then, a year after Menelaus got appointed, he started selling many of the temple's gold utensils. He didn't have enough money to pay the bribe off. And so he started selling the temple's gold to pay off the bribe. Well, that's pretty nasty. Onias III, the pious high priest, rebuked his brother Menelaus, the big bribe brother. And so Menelaus, the big bribe brother, had Onias III murdered. Another Cain and Abel story there. Well, Jason, the little bribe brother, didn't like that he had lost his office to Menelaus. So Jason gathered armies together and fought against Menelaus to regain the office of high priest. Well, Antiochus Epiphanes came into Jerusalem in 171 to defend Menelaus, the big bribe brother. He wanted Menelaus to win because Menelaus had paid him a bigger bribe than Jason, the small bribe brother. Well, all of this shows that the state of Israel was very sinful at the time, and so that's probably the rebellion that's being referred to in Daniel 8, verse 12. Because of that rebellion, a host, if we refer that to Israel, I think we can, the stars of heaven, the host, are Israel, together with the daily sacrifice, will be given over. We've already seen the daily sacrifice has been given over. The horn, that's the little horn, will throw truth to the ground. Adam Clark says, this refers to, probably, the whole Jewish religion and ritual is being thrown to the ground. And the little horn will be successful in whatever it does. Now, that doesn't mean in general in his whole life. It means he will be successful in whatever he does against Israel. And, of course, he was successful until the very end when the Seleucids were kicked out by the Maccabees and the temple was rededicated and cleansed from all that pig's blood. That happened in 164 after Antiochus had left Israel. And it was the same year, ironically, that Antiochus Epiphanes was taken off to the afterlife. Now, I would be remiss if I did not read you a little bit, at least, from the Apocrypha concerning Antiochus Epiphanes IV. The first passage is from 1 Maccabees 1, verses 29 through 32. And after 2 years fully expired, the king sent his chief collector of tribute into the cities of Judah, who came into Jerusalem with a great multitude and spake peaceable words unto them. This is from the King James version of it, so excuse the King James English. So this tax collector spake peaceable words unto the Jews, but all was deceit, for when they had given him credence, he fell suddenly upon the city and smote it very sore and destroyed much people of Israel. And when he had taken the spoils of the city, he set it on fire and pulled down the houses and walls thereof on every side. But the women and children took they captive and possessed the cattle. We also read in 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verses 52 through 61 the following. Then many of the people were gathered unto them, to wit every one that forsook the law, and so they committed evils in the land, and drove the Israelites into secret places, even wheresoever they could flee for succor. Now the 15th day of the month, this translation has Kaslu, that's Kislev, in the 145th year, they set up the abomination of desolation upon the altar. Now, folks, this is not the same abomination of desolation that Jesus mentioned in the Olivet Discourse. Many people try to equate the two. No, abomination means idolatry. Desolation means it causes destruction. And in this case, it's talking about the pig that Antiochus Epiphanes put on the bronze altar and sacrificed. They set up the abomination of desolation upon the altar and builded idol altars throughout the cities of Judah on every side, and burnt incense at the doors of their houses and in the streets. And when they had rent in pieces the books of the law which they found, they burnt them with fire. And whosoever was found with any the book of the testament, or if any committed to the law, the king's commandment was that they should put him to death. Thus did they by their authority unto the Israelites every month to as many as were found in the cities. Now the 25th day of the month they did sacrifice upon the idol altar, which was upon the altar of God, at which time, according to the commandment, they put to death certain women that had caused their children to be circumcised, and they hanged the infants about their necks and rifled their houses and slew them that had circumcised them, slew the women that had circumcised their children. So we see that Antiochus has persecuted the Jews. Now we're going to see Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes blaspheming God by trampling on God's laws. In 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verses 41 through 50, we read this. Moreover, King Antiochus wrote to his whole kingdom that all should be one people, and everyone should leave his laws, so all the heathen agreed according to the commandment of the king. In other words, Antiochus was trying to paganize the whole kingdom of the Seleucids, and Israel was under Seleucid dominion at the time. Yea, many also of the Israelites consented to his religion and sacrificed unto idols and profaned the Sabbath. For the king had sent letters by messengers unto Jerusalem and the cities of Judah that they should follow the strange laws of the land and forbid burnt offerings and sacrifice. That's where the daily sacrifice was probably stopped right there, this reference to that in verse 45. And forbid burnt offerings and sacrifice and drink offerings in the temple, and that they should profane the Sabbaths and festival days, and pollute the sanctuary and holy people, set up altars and groves and chapels of idols, and sacrifice swine's flesh and unclean beast, that they should also leave their children uncircumcised and make their souls abominable with all manner of uncleanness and profanation, to the end they might forget the law and change all the ordinances. And whosoever would not do according to the commandment of the king, he should die. So you see, this was a big deal to the Jews, this Antiochus Epiphanes the Fourth. And we need to remember that once the Maccabees rose up under all this provocation and ran the Seleucids out of town, the Jews rededicated their temple, 25 Kislev 164, and that is where the Feast of Hanukkah comes from, which of course is still being celebrated today. We go now to Daniel chapter 8, verses 13 through 14. Daniel continues, Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the speaker, How long will the events of this vision last? The daily sacrifice, the rebellion that makes desolate, and the giving over of the sanctuary and of the host to be trampled. He said to me, For 2300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary will be restored. Now Daniel heard two holy ones speaking one to another. Many commentators say it's Jesus speaking to the other holy one being an angel. There's no evidence for that. It could just be two angels. We're not going to worry about that. Now, in verse 13, one of the angels, one of the holy ones, asks a question. How long will the events of this vision last? Well, what are the events of this vision? Well, there's two options. You could say all of the vision, including the goat goring the ram, or it could be just the events concerning Antiochus Epiphanes the Fourth. And I believe that's what it is, because in the Holman Christian Study Bible translation, we have, How long will the events of this vision last? Dash, the daily sacrifice, the rebellion that makes desolate, and the giving over the sanctuary and of the host to be trampled. In other words, Antiochus Epiphanes' doings. So that's what we're going to take it as. And the host will be trampled. That's one of the things that happened in the vision, if you recall. And remember, the host is Israel. So in other words, how long will the daily sacrifice, bad event number one, be taken away with, and how long will the desecration of the sanctuary last? And the answer is given in verse 14. One of the angels said, For 2,300 evenings and mornings. Well now, what is this 2,300 evenings and mornings? Well, the end of this period is obviously the restoration of the sanctuary, because in verse 14 he said to me, Then the sanctuary will be restored at the end of the 2,300 evenings and mornings. And of course we know that happened in December of 164 when Hanukkah took place, the first Hanukkah. So that's not hard. The next question is when is the beginning point of this 2,300 evenings and mornings? Well, we have a difference of opinion as to how to interpret 2,300, because it says 2,300 evenings and mornings. Is evening and morning, is that a day, so it's 2,300 days? Or do you take it this way, an evening is one and morning is two, and so you have to divide 2,300 by two? Doing that gives you 1,150 days. Well, we need to realize that we don't have the precise dates for all these events in Maccabees. So it makes it impossible to calculate precisely the beginning date of when this 2,300-day or 1,150-day period began. Now, I'm not going to mention the arguments in favor of 2,300 days as opposed to 1,125 days. I will leave that to the scholars. I'll just give you both options. If you take it as 2300 days, the start date of the 2300 days is 171 BC. That's the year that Antiochus Epiphanes IV first began his persecution in earnest. This was the run-up to the 168 date when Antiochus Epiphanes IV conquered Jerusalem. What happened in 171? In the fall of 171, Onias III, the pious high priest, was murdered by Menelaus. He's the big bribe-taking brother I mentioned earlier. Antiochus Epiphanes had appointed him high priest by bribery, Menelaus. Now, before that date, there had been perfect peace between Antiochus Epiphanes IV and Israel, says Barnes. But then Antiochus IV's appointee, who gave him the bribe, Menelaus, he defiled the holy place. He stripped the furniture. Remember, he needed to sell the furniture to pay off the bribe. And that is what started the Jewish hatred for Antiochus Epiphanes IV. And so that's a good place to start the 2300 days. Now, let me read you from Wikipedia the comments of a Daniel scholar named C.L. Siao. He's Oriental. I don't know where he's from, somewhere in the East. He teaches at Vanderbilt, or he did. C.L. Siao, a leading Daniel scholar, takes it to mean 2,300 full days. This would be equivalent to about 7 years, assuming that the end point is the rededication of the temple and restoration of sacrifices in 164 BC, which of course we do assume that. The starting point would then be the murder of the high priest Onias III in 171, another notable year in the events leading up to the desecration. Now, that interpretation emphasizes that the period of time is when the host is to be trampled at the end of verse 13. How long will the vision last? The daily sacrifice, the rebellion that makes desolate, the giving over the sanctuary, and of the host to be trampled. The host to be trampled would include the whole vision starting from the very beginning point of the opposition of Israel to Antiochus IV. Now, that fits 2300 days pretty good, but now if we take the events of the vision and we emphasize the giving over of the sanctuary, then the 1,125-day version seems to work better. This, as a matter of fact, is the majority view. 1,150 days, counting backwards from the termination date, which is the rededication of the temple on Kislev 25, 164, the original Hanukkah. No debate about that. We count back 1,150 days, and we actually almost get to the desecration of the sanctuary. The starting date of our period would then be in Tishri, September, October of 167. We know that the desecration of the sanctuary was in December of 167, which is a couple months off. Or I say we know, the actual only date that's actually known is when Antiochus Epiphanes IV set up an altar in the temple, which is in December of 167. You have to assume that he then did all that other stuff in December of 167, but 1,150 days doesn't put you in December 167. It puts you a couple months before. So here's a suggested solution to that. The 1,150 days is a close approximation. I don't like those solutions. This is a better solution. The daily sacrifice may have been abolished before that altar was erected in December of 167. Remember, as I said, bad event number one in this vision was the daily sacrifice. Also, the host is being trampled too, but it also refers more particularly to the daily sacrifice. And that could have easily have happened a couple of months before Antiochus desecrated the temple. Could have been Antiochus just said, no, you're not going to do the daily sacrifice anymore. That's perfectly reasonable. Unfortunately, we don't have the history to back Daniel up, but that doesn't mean a thing. Daniel's prophecies have been so right on that we take him as authoritative. Now, this desecration of the temple, which was somewhere around December of 167 or so, is described by Josephus. It's worth a read here, so let me read this to you. He, referring to Antiochus, got possession of the city by treachery, at which time he spared not so much as those that admitted him into it, on account of the riches that lay in the temple, but led by his covetous inclination, for he saw there was in it a great deal of gold and many ornaments that had been dedicated to it of very great value. And in order to plunder its wealth, he ventured to break the league he had made. So he left the temple bare, and took away the golden candlesticks, and the golden altar, and table, and the altar. That's probably referring to the bronze altar. And did not abstain even from the veils, which were made of fine linen and scarlet. He also emptied it of its secret treasures and left nothing at all remaining. And by this means cast the Jews into great lamentation, for he forbade them to offer those daily sacrifices which they used to offer to God according to the law. And when he had pillaged the whole city, some of the inhabitants he slew, and some he carried captive, together with their wives and children, so that the multitude of those captives that were taken alive amounted to about 10,000. He also burnt down the finest buildings, and when he had overthrown the city walls, he built a citadel in the lower part of the city, for the place was high, and overlooked the temple, on which account he fortified it with high walls and towers, and put into it a garrison of Macedonians. However, in that citadel dwelt the impious and wicked part of the multitude, from whom it proved that the citizens suffered many and sore calamities. And when the king had built an idol altar upon God's altar, he slew swine upon it, and so offered a sacrifice neither according to the law nor the Jewish religious worship in the country. He also compelled them to forsake the worship which they had paid their own God, and to adore those whom he took to be gods, and made them build temples, and raise idol altars in every city and village, and offer swine upon them every day. He also commanded them not to circumcise their sons, and threatened to punish any that should be found to have transgressed his injunction. He also appointed overseers, who should compel them to do what he commanded. And indeed, many Jews there who were complied with the king's commands... And indeed, many Jews there were who complied with the king's commands, either voluntarily or out of fear of the penalty that was denounced. But the best men, and those of the noblest souls, did not regard him, but did pay a greater respect to the customs of their country than concern as to the punishment which he threatened to the disobedient. On which account they every day underwent great miseries and bitter torments, for they were whipped with rods, and their bodies were torn to pieces, and were crucified while they were still alive and breathed. They also strangled those women and their sons whom they had circumcised, as the king had appointed, hanging their sons about their necks as they were upon the crosses. And if there were any sacred book of the law found, it was destroyed, and those with whom they were found miserably perished also. But we can see why the Jews don't like Antiochus Epiphanes the Fourth. We go now to Daniel 8, verses 15 through 19. While I, Daniel, was watching the vision and trying to understand it, there stood before me someone who appeared to be a man. Notice Daniel's trying to understand his own vision even as we do. The difference is he was some 380 years before the events. We are after the events. So while Daniel is trying to understand his vision, there stood before me someone who appeared to be a man. I heard a human voice calling from the middle of the Ulai. That's the Ulai River. Gabriel, explain the vision to this man. So he approached where I was standing. When he came near, I was terrified and fell face down. Son of man, he said to me, understand that the vision refers to the time of the end. While he was speaking to me, I fell into a deep sleep with my face to the ground. Then he touched me, made me stand up, and said, I am here to tell you what will happen at the conclusion of the time of wrath, because it refers to the appointed time of the end. Now, there was someone who appeared to be a man, who appeared before Daniel. Who is this someone who appeared to be a man? The majority view apparently is Gabriel. Barnes, Ellicott, Callan, Delitzsch, and Poole mention this that as an option. Some people say it's the Messiah, Jesus. Clark and Gill say that. Poole says that's an option. Some people say it's Michael, the archangel. Poole says that is an option. I don't know. It seems to me to be Gabriel, because the human voice called out from the middle of the Ulai and said, Gabriel, explain the vision. Sounds to me like it's Gabriel. I don't know why you would say something else. How about this human voice in verse 16 calling out to Gabriel? Guzik says it's just someone we don't know. Colin Delitzsch says it's an angel. Barnes says it's God. Benson said it's an angel, more particularly the angel that was speaking in verse 13. One angel speaking to another, if you recall that. One angel asked the other, how long is this vision going to last? 2,300 days, the other one said. These strange figures in these visions, they're not really that important. I just assume that it's Jesus appearing to Daniel, or in this case, calling to Daniel, calling to Gabriel, telling Gabriel to explain the vision to Daniel. Now, Gabriel means man of God, as Ellicott and Colin Delitzsch point out. This is the earliest instance of the naming of angels in the scripture, as the pulpit commentator points out. First time we hear the mention of an angel, Gabriel. He calls Daniel in verse 17 the son of man, or a son of man. We're so used to hearing that title used of Jesus the Messiah, but no, here it just means you, Daniel, or a son of man. Son of means you have the characteristics of, even as a human son has the characteristics of his father. So, Daniel, you have the characteristics of a man. Now, why would Gabriel say that to Daniel? Well, it could be a mark of honor and respect. I respect you as a man. It could be, as one commentator says, to express Gabriel's tender regard to Daniel and accommodating himself to him, considering he was a frail mortal man. In other words, I'm an angel, and you are a weak son of man, and I understand why you don't understand these things. Let me explain it to you. Or it could be that Gabriel was trying to humble Daniel, to put him in a mind that he should consider himself as a mere man. Even though he is now floating around amongst angels, having all these visions, favored with revelations of secrets, he needs to be reminded he is a mere man so that he might not be exalted above measure. I don't believe that Daniel was proud. I think he was terrified. It says, verse 17, I was terrified and fell face down. You need to humble somebody like that? I don't think so. I think he's just saying, I'm an angel, you're a man, I honor you as a man, I have regard for you as a man, and I'm going to explain the vision to you. Now, Gabriel is going to go on at the end of this chapter to explain the vision to Daniel, but he starts out by saying that this vision, what will happen is at the conclusion of the time of wrath, and this is the appointed time of the end. What does he mean by time of the end? Now, of course, futurists will say, oh, that's the end of the world. No, that's not what it is, in my humble opinion. It means the end of Alexander the Great's kingdom. It's going to be mopped up by the Romans in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. The last Greek kingdom went down in approximately 30 BC. I forgot the exact date, but it's the time when the Romans beat Cleopatra. She was the last of the Ptolemies. I think the Seleucids went down. I know that Israel got taken over by the Roman general in 63 BC. The history of the Roman Empire taking over the four horns of the goat is well documented. I can't remember a lot of it. It's a little bit fuzzy in my mind, but it's all there for the reading. And so the time of the end is the end of the goat's empire. John Gill says the same year that Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes set up the abomination of desolation in the temple at Jerusalem, that would be 167, Aemilius, the Roman consul, conquered Perseus, king of Macedon, whereby all Greece came into the hands of the Romans. Well, I guess you could say that's one of the four horns that got taken over by the Romans. The other ones, it took a little while after that. But the point is, the time of the end is the end of the Greek kingdom. That's what this whole chapter was about. The rise of Alexander the Great's goat kingdom and the fall of said kingdom. It's not about the end of the world, folks. It's not the end of the world. Now, I just gave you my humble opinion. Actually, there's a lot of other views on this as to what the time of the end refers to, so I'm going to give you, in the spirit of equity, a list of these options. John Gill says that the time of the end means the end of the 2300 days. That would be Hanukkah, Kislev 25, 164 BC, the first Hanukkah, the rededication and cleansing of the temple. Now, that would make sense, actually, because the 2300 days has just been talked about. Option number three, it refers to the end of the times of Antiochus Epiphanes, the time of the end of the little horn. He died in 164 after ruling Israel between 168 and 165. So that time period was about 165. Matthew Henry says at the end of the Jewish polity, when Antiochus Epiphanes wipes out Israel, that's the end of the Jews' kingdom. Well, that's reasonable too. Option number four, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, who's not a dispensationalist, says this refers to the end of the future Antichrist. Apparently, Martin Luther believed that too. John Calvin says, hence Luther, indulging his thoughts too freely, refers this passage to the mask of Antichrist. So you see, it's not just dispensationalists who are afflicted with the futurist bug. Option number five, this is referring to the end of Antiochus Epiphanes the Fourth and the future Antichrist. In other words, Antiochus Epiphanes IV is a type of the future Antichrist. That's the opinion of Guzik, the dispensationalist commentator. Option number six, this is from Adam Clark. Quote, the vision shall have an end at the proper time. Well, now that's very helpful, is it not? Option number seven, we don't know, and we shouldn't worry about it. Well, I think this is a quote from Adam Clark. It is fixed in the divine counsel, which cannot be altered and which must not be pried into. Well, I think that's a little bit shy. We can pry into it. I think he's talking about the end of the Greek kingdom, although it could be the end of the 2300 days. So I will not be so dogmatic, and I will back down and say, I'll report it. You decide when the times of the end occur. But let's point out that it does not necessarily have to be the time of the end when the Antichrist is roaming the earth. There are plenty of other valid options to avoid that conclusion. Now, there is a phrase in verse 19 which makes one want to take the time of the end to refer to the end of the 2300 days, because we read in verse 19, Gabriel speaking, Gabriel says, I am here to tell you what will happen at the conclusion of the time of wrath, because it refers to the appointed time of the end. So the time of wrath is the time of the end. Well, that makes sense to refer that time of wrath to the wrath of Antiochus Epiphanes on the Jews that ended in 164 with the Maccabean revolt and the rededication of the temple. All right, so I've changed my mind right in the midst of the podcast. I think that Gabriel here is talking about the end of the 2300 days. We go now to Daniel 8, verses 20 through 22, and Gabriel will now explain the vision to Daniel. The two-horned ram that you saw represents the kings of Media and Persia. The shaggy goat represents the king of Greece, and the large horn between his eyes represents the first king. The four horns that took the place of the shattered horn represent four kingdoms. They will rise from that nation, but without its power. Well, the large horn represents the first king. That's obviously Alexander the Great. The four kingdoms that come out of the shattered horn, that's the Diadochy. We've already talked about that. The Diadochy will rise from the nation of Greece, but without its power, obviously. None of the individual Diadochy had the power of Alexander the Great. We go now to Daniel 8, verses 23 through 26. Near the end of their kingdoms, when the rebels have reached the full measure of their sin, an insolent king, skilled in intrigue, will come to the throne. Now we're talking about Antiochus Epiphanes IV. Gabriel's talking about him. His power will be great, but it will not be his own. He will cause terrible destruction and succeed in whatever he does. He will destroy the powerful along with the holy people. He will cause deceit to prosper through his cunning and by his influence. And in his own mind, he will make himself great. He will destroy many in a time of peace. He will even stand against the prince of princes, yet he will be shattered, not by human hands. The vision of the evenings and the mornings that has been told is true. That's the 2300 days. Now you must seal up the vision because it refers to many days in the future. All right, in verse 23, Gabriel says near the end of their kingdoms. Now that end is not the end of the 2300 days. This end here is the end of the Diadochy's kingdoms, the four kingdoms, and of course, Antiochus Epiphanes IV, who conquered Israel between 168 and 165, that is near the end of the Greek kingdoms. The Greek kingdom is just about to be mopped up by the Romans in time of Antiochus Epiphanes. I've already mentioned this. Macedon went down at about the same time. Gill says it's the same year. And so we're about to change over to the fourth kingdom, the monstrous, ferocious beast that was given in Daniel's vision 2 years earlier in chapter 7. So that's the end of the Greek kingdoms is being referred to here in verse 23. When the rebels have reached the full measure of their sin, this is referring to the Jews who had carried their sins to the limit. Adam Clark says, when the utmost degradation had taken place by the buying and selling of the high priesthood, for Ananias was rejected for a sum of money to make room for the wicked Jason, that's the little bribe brother, and Jason again was supplanted for a greater sum by a worse man, if possible, than himself, Menelaus, that's the big bribe brother, and the golden vessels of the temple were sold to pay for the sacrilegious purchase. Menelaus did that to pay his bribe. So the Jewish rebels had reached the full measure of their sins, and at that time an insolent king, that would refer to Antiochus Epiphanes IV. We've read enough of First Maccabees and Josephus to see that he was insolent. Guzik says another translation should be he had fierce features. Okay, he's insolent. Insolent's a sort of mild translation. He was a nasty SOB. He was skilled in intrigue. He was known for his cruel brutality, of course, but he was also skilled in intrigue. He was known for his flattery and smooth tongue. His power will be great, but not his own. Now, here are some options as to where Antiochus Epiphanes IV's power came from. Guzik says it came from Satan. John Gill says it came from Alexander the Great, because Antiochus Epiphanes was one of the successor kingdoms. He didn't have the power that Alexander the Great had. Antiochus Epiphanes IV, however, did not use military power like Alexander. Rather, he used craft and deceit. Some people say that his power came from God to chastise the Jews. His power will not be his own. Gabriel continues in verse 24, he will cause terrible destruction and succeed in whatever he does, and he did for a while until he got wiped out, of course. It just means in the time of his ascendancy. We read all about that in 1 Maccabees and in Josephus. He will succeed in whatever he does. He will destroy the powerful along with the holy people. Holy people is a translation that could be translated saints. So he succeeds. Guzik says another translation is he will prosper and thrive. He did that. He will kill the powerful in verse 24. He will destroy the powerful. Well, John Gill says the powerful are the Egyptians, the Parthians, and other nations he made war with. The Parthians are to his east, to the east of Antioch, to the east of Syria, where Persia is. And, of course, the Egyptians are to the south, and he had a couple of campaigns down there. Along with the holy people, that would be the Jews, from 168 to 165. Verse 25, this little horn, Antiochus Epiphanes IV, will cause deceit to prosper through his cunning and his influence. John Gill says an example of this is how Antiochus Epiphanes IV got the kingdom of Syria from his nephew, and also how under a pretense of peace and friendship, he defended Philometor VI of Ptolemy of Egypt, who was a minor. He says, I'll take care of you, Ptolemy. And then he made large promises to the nobles of Egypt and made himself master of Egypt. And also, John Gill says, by deceitful methods he prevailed in Judea. I guess that's by all the bribery he did of the high priest, or all the bribery he received from those who wanted to be high priest. Verse 25, in his own mind, he, the little horn, will make himself great. Guzik says the coins of Antiochus Epiphanes were inscribed with this title, Theos Epiphanius. I've got a transliteration here. I don't have the Greek, so I might have pronounced that wrong. But the Greek phrase means God manifest, like an epiphany. Like an epiphany is the manifestation of God. So Antiochus Epiphanes thought he was an epiphany. He was God manifest. So yeah, that's pretty good. 25, he will make himself great. He will destroy many in a time of peace. John Gill says, under a pretense of peace, he will enter into countries and destroy the inhabitants of them, as in Egypt and Judea, or by leagues and treaties of peace, outwitting those he made peace with. He will even stand against the prince of princes. Gabriel continues, who's the prince of princes? Who's in charge of all the princes of the world? Well, that would be God. Yet he, Antiochus IV Epiphanes, the little horn, will be shattered not by human hands. Well, as a matter of fact, Antiochus Epiphanes died of disease, not by war, not by assassination. We read that in 2 Maccabees 9, verses 5 and 9. But the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, smote him with an incurable and invisible plague, or as soon as he had spoken these words, a pain of the bowels that was remediless came upon him, and sore torments of the inner parts, so that the worms rose up out of the body of this wicked man, and whilst he lived in sorrow and pain, his flesh fell away, and the filthiness of his smell was noisome to all his army. I love that King James translation. Gives it a dramatic effect. So just as Gabriel says, the little horn died not with human hands. Verse 26, the vision of the evenings and the mornings that has been told is true. That's 2,300 days before the temple is rededicated. And that's why I think the time of the end is what this prophecy is about. When the wrath is over, when the wrath of Antiochus Epiphanes IV is over, and the temple has been reestablished. That's the context. I changed my mind on that when I said that the end was about the end of the four horns. No, I think it's the end of the 2,300 days. Gabriel finishes in verse 26 and says, now you, Daniel, must seal up the vision. Why? Because it refers to many days in the future. Daniel is prophesying in 550 BC, the third year of Belshazzar. Antiochus Epiphanes attacked Israel in 168 or so. And so if you subtract 168 from 550, you get 382 years approximately in the future. That's a long time in the future. And so Gabriel says, seal up the vision, Daniel, so far in the future. Well now, why would Gabriel tell Daniel to seal up the future? It's not so that the Jews would be prevented from knowing. That's why the prophecy was given. The prophecy was given for Jews, so it wasn't to hide it from the Jews. So here are three options as to why Daniel was told to seal the vision. Option number one, so the Babylonians wouldn't know. Now, in this vision, we have the ram, that's Persia, butting people to the north, west, and south. And, of course, the Babylonians are to the west of the Persians. They might not like hearing about such a vision, and they might have been unhappy with the messenger, Daniel. And so Gabriel says, seal up the vision. That's option number one. Option number two, so that the Persians wouldn't know. If the Persians found out about this vision, they might be disgusted to see their empire trampled on by this conspicuous horn and this goat. And remember, Daniel still has to work for the Persians. He's working for the Babylonians right now in 553 BC. But after 539, and Gabriel probably knew this, after 539, the Persians are going to take over Babylon, and Daniel is still going to be working for the Persians. He doesn't need to get them angry. Option number three is to why Daniel was told to seal the vision is because it would not be easy to understand the vision until it's just about to be fulfilled. So keep it safe until the future events happen, and then people will understand what you're prophesying about. But if you let people know about it now, they're going to say, what? Who is this goat? Who are these four successor kingdoms? They won't have a clue. And then they will start mocking you and making fun of you and making fun of God. So let's just keep it quiet until it's time. We go now to the last verse in Daniel 8, verse 27. I, Daniel, was overcome and lay sick for days. Then I got up and went about the king's business. I was greatly disturbed by the vision and could not understand it. Daniel was sick for days after having a vision. Daniel probably could not understand why God would allow such a nasty little horn to do his work on the Jews. Remember, this little horn's coming against the beautiful land in the vision. And the vision talked about desolations that were coming on the land of Israel, the city, the temple, the people. That made him sick. You know, Daniel's probably waiting for the 70 years of Jeremiah to be over so the Jews can leave Babylon and go back to Israel around 539 or 538, 537, right around that time. And that's what he's looking forward to. And all of a sudden he gets this prophecy that says that Israel's going to get whacked by this little horn. So yeah, he was sick. But then he got over it. He got up and went about the king's business. The king, of course, is Belshazzar of Babylon, the regent of Babylon. Now notice Daniel, after having this great spiritual vision, he went back to his job. Daniel wasn't so spiritual and visionary that he couldn't work. There are a lot of people like that, you know. Oh, God, God, God. But they can't lift their hand to do a little bit of honest work. Daniel wasn't like that. He finishes off the chapter by saying he was greatly disturbed by the vision, and we just saw why, and he could not understand it. Daniel's not the only one who's had trouble interpreting Daniel's visions. I've been struggling through this podcast trying to do so. And so the vision is sealed up in light of its ultimate fulfillment in Daniel's distant future, almost 400 years later. Daniel never did know how it was fulfilled. Maybe he knows in heaven now. I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if God told him, Daniel, this is how accurate your prophecy was. So, ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished chapter 8 of Daniel. We're ready to go now to Daniel 9, the 70 weeks. Now, you think chapter 8 was hard. Daniel 9, the 70 weeks, is going to be harder. But nonetheless, I hope you stay with me, and I'll take a whack at it, try to interpret Daniel 9 for you. So we'll see you in our next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.